Welcome back to the Weekly Manga Podcast. This is the podcast where you talk about all of your favorite ongoing Japanese manga. This week, there's a brand new series from Beastars and Sanda author Paro Itagaki called Ushimitsu Gao, or Her Face at the Witching Hour. After that, we will catch up with the flashback arc of Akane Banashi, as we get some big pieces filled in with that story, and we'll finish up with Drunk Bullet, a really fantastic newer series with an emotional ending to an arc. All that, manga news and more, coming right up. Hello again, my name is Bruce. I am the proprietor of the White Gray Black YouTube channel. This week I am joined again by the bullet to my drunk, Gautam.
Hello, hello.
Special shout out and thanks to our Patreon subscribers, Yaji Black. If you want to have your name read at the top of the episode, see some bonus content, and support us, check out patreon.com/WGBmanga. Starts at $3. So, Gautam, let's talk about our troubled history with Paro Itagaki. This is her new series called Ushimitsu Gao, or Her Face at the Witching Hour, which is a weird and kinky one, I would say. So if you're, how old do you have to be to have a YouTube account? Is it 13 or 14, or is that Twitch?
You know what? Let's just say you have to be 17 to listen to this conversation.
Yes. If you're not, yeah, if you don't think you're old enough for this, you're not. We're not going to show, obviously, everything should be TOS, but this is about sex and marriage and kink play, kind of, with a ghost.
It is like, okay, so with the Paro Itagaki thing, I expected it to be more, funny. But it was very much just...
I actually thought it was really smart, funny, but...
It was more smutty than I thought it would be.
Oh, really? I just thought it was less, but that's interesting. I have weird feelings about this because to me, this feels like the best thing Paro Itagaki has ever done to me. And I think that is because this feels the most true to her.
I appreciate that it talks about female horniness more. Because I think as horny as anime is, it revolves around male horniness.
Primarily, so, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. This is like have you seen the movie Ghost?
I haven't, but I know about it.
Yeah, this is
like the pottery scene and yeah.
Yeah, this is like skipping the foreplay of Ghost. Let's get into it.
Yeah, for sure. I one more thing I wanted to bring up is I've read some of Beastars, not all of it. We tried to read Sanda. Both of those feel like
Beastars.
Okay, so you maybe can talk a little bit more. Beastars always felt like it had a little bit of this undertone of like, hey, like who, the rabbit is it? What's the rabbit's name? Haru? Is that right?
I think it is. It's been a while.
I don't remember.
I think it's Haru and Legoshi, right?
Yeah. I think that's right. Like the rabbit in Beastars. Also a kinky little rabbit. Like, straight.
I mean, that's just rabbits, right?
Yes, but I guess what I'm trying to say is that I feel like there has always been this weird underpinning in Paro Itagaki's works where it's like, she really wants to like write about these things, like because they are pervasive and perverse. That's a good one.
I think she's just a horn dog.
Yeah, which is why I think that this is like, which is why reading this, I was like, yeah, this feels like straight up, like honest and straightforward, and like she's firing on all cylinders to me. So
I liked it too. Yeah. With that said, I feel like the target demo is maybe 33-year-old women.
Maybe. I don't know yet. I could definitely appreciate it as a 34-year-old man, but let's get through it and talk about it. So, two chapters are out. I only have some pictures here from chapter one. We'll talk a little bit more about chapter two. Chapter two is basically, she just like embraces all the stuff that happens in chapter one. So, starts off with our lead character here in bed being like, oh, ghosts don't like erotic stuff. So if you ever encounter one, think of something reverse. They'll hate it and leave. And she's basically having sex with her husband. And saying like that's not real as a ghost watches her and her husband have sex and man I of all the feelings I had this husband is a shitter, right? Like
dude, I'm glad you thought so because I'm like uh I I'm glad this is told from, like, not like a floating narrator, but her point of view. Because she like gives him the generous take of, oh, he's just a clumsy husband who lacks confidence. But yeah, no, he's a scumbag.
He's a fucking,
Are you not satisfied again? Or is that what you're going to tell me? It's like, remember, no matter what, we're not going to do it until your next ovulation date. It's like, what are you fucking talking about, you prick?
Yeah, and she's like, I'll make your favorite food, like, it'll be awesome, I'm so, like, wonderful, the house is clean, like, and he's just like, I will be home late, goodbye. Like, he's so, he is not a compelling character, which I think makes the story work, because if he was even a little bit redeemable, you would be like, I don't know, is she cheating with the ghost? Which is kind of a thing that she goes through for one chapter, and then the second chapter, she kind of embraces it, but, the husband was not,
Well, and you know what I liked? I liked that she gives the husband like a generous read of saying, oh, he's just an awkward guy. But you as the Paru lets the audience easily determine that he is a scumbag shithead, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And she's in that kind of relationship. Even though the narrator says he's just an awkward dude, you and I and every audience member is just like, wow, what a dick, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I know that there's a little bit of Japanese cultural stuff where it's like, you know, I don't think it's maybe so present in modern day couples or more recent couples, but I know that years and years ago, there was much more of an accepting, like, I mean, this is true in America too, in the 50s and 60s, right? Like, the wife stays at home and the guy can go do whatever he wants and it doesn't matter. You're beholden to him and all that jazz. So I think that maybe stuck around in Japan with, I know they have a interesting relationship with, like, I don't want to say cheating culture, but like, there's a lot more acceptance around a husband, like, going to a soap land or something, right? Than there would be in other places. So,
and you know, I have to bet that just like here in the States, it's like becoming increasingly more progressive in terms of like sexuality and cheating, all that stuff, which is why like a story like this, you can paint a character with the this old fashioned mindset as kind of the villain, and even the audience member, like the Japanese audience members, would get it because the target demo is probably like 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds who think differently.
And I think part of Itagaki is like my age.
Yeah.
Like she's like, I wonder how old she is, but I think she's like probably around my age.
I have to guess 33, like this character, right?
I wonder. Yeah, I want to see. No, she is younger. She is 31, but close.
Oh, it's so aspirational.
Yeah, she was writing B-Stars when I was in college, probably. This page right here I really liked, because this is something I really like about Paru Itagaki's art, which I do not always like, is the kind of expressiveness of her characters, like the different expressions here where she's like thinking about spirits and then she like, oh, sees them, and then she's kind of like fed up with like, oh, just ignore them, and then she has the like big eyes, like frustrated here. Like, I really love this. Like, I think this is a really expressive character, and the art really shows it off.
I love how the spirits are just these, like, two, like, silly drawn people with goofy eyes in the background.
Yeah, they're just, like, nothing. But I that's really good. I just think, like, it's... And for some reason, this just didn't work for me in Sanda. Maybe she spent all of Sanda, like, practicing getting better at drawing humans, because I don't have the same problems I had with the humans in Sanda as I do in this series. Like, the humans that were all, you know, they're weird and stylized in her style, but they aren't, like, off-puttingly weird like they were often in Sanda.
I guess I didn't have issue with how the humans looked so much in Sanda, more so that I thought that all of the characters were like,
there was more weird unlikeable. The way things looked to that series. Yeah.
Exactly. I think it was like a combination of factors.
Yeah,
but yeah, anyway,
but I do definitely think that like she's just improving and her style is unique, and I like the facial expressions she's looking, and she can kind of tell that the ghost is there, like watching her talk to her friend. Then in chapter one here, the ghost starts like visiting her at night and putting her in sleep, quote unquote, sleep paralysis, which is not actually sleep paralysis, later we learn. And he just like, he stares at her. And it's just, I don't know. It's just, this is a weird series. In a couple of pages, you basically find out that like, she is very excited by being restrained by him. At night, he finally like touches her, and she basically like has an orgasm. Her husband wakes up, and she's like playing it cool.
Pretends to be asleep. Yeah,
pretends to be asleep.
I love the orgasm being like represented by a roller coaster. hitting its peak climax and then like ramping down.
Yeah, she like it like hits here and then he like grabs her face and then it's like she next time she's just like I was literally soaked. I mean we talk about how it's like it's good that it's from a female point of view. I like that it's also like not reserving itself for its audience, right? It's just like it's a horny 33-year-old girl. She's just like I was soaking wet last night. Like, she's very honest, which I appreciate that a lot.
It's like I guess it's like night and day compared to like her husband in the first part of the chapter mm-hmm. where she's like I wish he touched my boobs and it's like this dude's like putting in no work at all.
Yeah,
like
and the ghost is like a list of bondage play he's going through with her and slowly escalating. But she finds out that he wasn't actually sleep paralysis. He was literally doing what is this called, the like Japanese tying bondage thing to her at night. So and because she has like rope burns on her body, she's like drooling at the end of chapter one. She's like why am I drooling? And she kind of knows like, hey, he's gonna come back night after night. This is, I think, the last page I have. Chapter two, she basically, like, she sets up some salt cups and tries to drive him off, which he, like, plays with. And she's like, ooh, he's so confident. He's just messing with the salt I'm using to drive him off. And by the end of chapter two, she's like, fucking bring it, ghost boy. I'm ready. Like, come please me. Oh, man. It's just very, I don't know. This is an endearing, funny, like, adult series that, I don't know, I found myself liking a lot, so.
It is both like goofy and horny at the same time.
I really appreciated the comedy of it too.
Yeah. And I don't know. I guess I'll say it's like, it's not horny in a porn way, but it's horny in a endearing and human way.
Human. Kind of honest. It like doesn't, so far it isn't like going, it isn't being horny for us as the reader. The character inside the story is horny. Like that's which I always appreciate more when you're doing, you know, a ecchi or kind of sexual series like this.
Yeah, I guess it's like I don't know how to describe it aside from it's a series. Instead of making like the byproduct isn't to make the reader horny. It's a story about horniness.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's exactly right. The horniness is contained inside the pages. Is not really meant to make you horny, unless like you mentioned, like maybe you're a 33-year-old married woman with an awful husband and like maybe you see yourself in this enough that it works for you. I don't know.
Hey, yeah, maybe it's a 50 Shades situation where I don't know, this is hitting close to home.
There, no way. It's so funny you say that. There is an angle of like 50 Shades Twilight, like, oh, I have a ghost bondage master, and then I'm married and unhappily. There's an angle to that in this. But yeah, I don't know. I like this. I thought it was fun. Like I said, to me, this feels like Haru Tagaki is finally getting to write something that is, she isn't covering up the things she really wants to write about with weird, like, Santa superheroes or, like, high school animal stuff. It's just like, this is kind of what I feel like she's always wanted to write about. That's kind of the feeling I've gotten. She's always wanted to be like write about like girls being horny and weird kink stuff. Like that's always been in her stories. So
I feel like she you know, I think the good thing about Paru is that I don't think she thinks about what her audience wants when she writes. I think everything she has written is something she has wanted to write, and she doesn't consider her audience one bit, because if you think about it, right, like Beastars captured both male and female audiences. Mm-hmm. Santa, who knows? I assume dudes. But like, I don't even know how to describe Santa's demo.
Because it might only be Paru Itagaki. I think you're right. I think the only person who's into like a scrawny high school aged boy turning into the most muscular, like, I think she's just like, I have a Santa kink and wrote about it for 3 years. Like, I literally think that might be why she wrote that.
And you know, I think everybody thinks about metrics of success. How well will this do? Who does this appeal to? Mm-hmm. Everybody thinks about that, except seemingly Paru, who doesn't, who just like walks forward with what she wants to do, regardless of whether it will be successful or not. And whether it resonates or not is up to you. But people like this need to exist, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
It's like I and. The funny thing is, I think everything she does resonates in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's like a bizarre small part of your soul that you didn't think was there, you're just like, huh, yeah, I get you.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that it's refreshing after we cover so many series from Weekly Shonen Jump, which feel so doctored and tailored to an audience and kind of designed to try to capture a group of people, that this is on the other side where it's just like, who is this for exactly? And the answer is, it's really only for Baru Itagaki. And if you're into it too, cool, come on the ride with her. So this feels like in stark contrast to those types of series. And this is why I think I really, really like this series so far.
You know what? I'll even say that I don't even think this one is for me, but I appreciate that it exists and it put me in a good mood reading it, because like, I think everything she puts out, I can like feel the earnesty in the writing. If that makes sense. It's like, I don't know. We've read so much Shonen Jump stuff that we know exactly where a chapter is going and what the beats are. And we see the quota being hit in real time of, mention your friends, come back around to show that you're actually a good guy. You know, like normal tropes. It's like refreshing reading something like this.
Like this kind of, I guess in the same way that you're like, this seems designed just for her and it seems very honest, this kind of seems like an editor never saw it and she just published it. Like, don't you think? I don't think an
it
editor
does feel
would.
Like that, yeah.
Or if she had an editor, she was like, cool, great, yeah, let's go. Like there was no consideration other than the authors, which I think is great, yeah. I think I'm a little bit more into this than you are just for whatever reason, but I don't know. I appreciated the honesty of this a lot.
And hey, you know what? Like I enjoyed it too. It was a good time.
Yeah. Cool. anything else to say on, and I missed the title, Ushimitsu Gao by Paru Itagaki. Anything else?
No. Paru does it again.
Yeah. Another strange thing from Paru Itagaki. I need to go back and read Beastars or maybe watch it. I've heard the 3D anime by Studio Orange is very well regarded. So, and I liked what I read. I just didn't quite make it through. So
Beastars is excellent.
Cool. Let's talk about Akane Banashi. This is chapter 136 by Yuki Tsunaga and Takamasu Moe. We are in a flashback right now in Akane Banashi. So we are basically learning about the two kind of masters whose names I'm going to forget. The Akane's master, and then I think his name's Isho is the other one. And yeah, so we meet kind of at the end of last chapter and the start of this one, we meet Kiroku Kashiwaya. His master is Miroku Kashiwaya. This is why names are hard in Japanese. The inheritor of Miroku, the venerable Miyoseki of the Kashiwaya school. This is the old guard, old guard. This guy would have been probably doing Rakugo through the war would be kind of what I would say, because I think this flashback takes place what, like late 60s, maybe early 60s, something like that.
He is dead. This guy is dead in present day. Yeah,
this guy is definitely dead present day. So we're getting this flashback kind of told to Akane by the female Rakugo master, whose again name I have forgotten.
Sorry we forget the names. There's so much shit, and there are a million billion.
If they don't mention that, I have to give it to My Hero Academia anime, is that you will never forget those characters' names, because every single time they appear on screen, it tells you their name and their power. And you know what?
Yeah.
You know what? People get annoyed by that. But on the other hand, I will not forget those characters' names, because they are told to me over and over and over.
Yeah.
And stuff like this, where it's like, you know,
Akane's beautiful hot master.
Yeah. Who is actually the same age as her master, who just had a heart attack, or close to the same age at least.
That's a great gag.
I think it's funny, because she's, a couple chapters ago, they're like, wait, how old are you? She's like, do not ask that. she's like, I assume like early 60s, I think is where most 60, of these people
probably
are. It basically says that, hey, like your master and Isho, they basically did not get to perform for 2 years, which is kind of unheard of. We even saw from the history of Akane. We kind of told, like, your master's word is law. If he says you can't take the stage, you have to obey. But they're like, hey, luckily these two guys, like, they aren't discouraged by not being able to perform. They're like, they're still into it. They're still learning.
Okay, so this is a silly question, but which one of these guys is Shiguma, and which one is
Shiguma Michelle? Is the short-haired one. Shiguma is okay, this guy
okay
on the left.
Okay, or, yeah, the cheery, guy, the yeah cheery one. Yeah, yeah, that makes
the
sense.
Long-haired one is the quote-unquote bad guy. I think is Isho.
Isho,
so.
Yeah,
yeah, makes yeah sense. If he has long, I also had to look at this because I realized like they both have weird eyebrows, but I don't remember which weird eyebrows was the good one. But I realized like long hair pointing down is bad guy Isho, and if his hair points up, it's the master of Akane. So
okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, but so they we kind of get this like, hey, master's word is law. This is and which is like seems to be really key to the stuff that's coming up and the stuff in this chapter. But it's like, hey, they still have faith. It's like, who do they have faith in? It's like it's obvious. It's like their master who is awesome. And this is where shit gets really cool because. They're like, most of all, Master was a pioneer. Like, his arts started with the refined skill of the classic traditionalist, and on top of that foundation, wove a tapestry of stories according to his own whims. I want you to look at the pictures that are drawn here of this master to me, and to a lot of other people. I saw some comments pointing out this too. They look almost exactly like the way that Akane performs, which I think is like very telling.
Like, oh, okay.
Like, doesn't this look exactly like an Akane pose on the left here? Like,
it does.
And
it
like
does,
on the right, this is exactly the same kind of background she gets when she does Rakugo. Like,
I didn't put that together. Yeah, that's a good call out.
Yeah, because this is, I mean, and we sort of have, maybe we talked about this last time we brought a chapter here, but Akane learned the whatever that old story was that no one else had known and been able that no one had been able to perform since this guy, right? And now we basically get reinforcement that like, hey, this guy performs, or like I guess it would be more appropriate to say Akane performs just like their old master, like Shikuma's old master, right?
Right.
And so I think this is really cool to see that this kind of like lines up the whole story that like, oh, of course he's the kind of performer exactly like Akane combined is exactly the same kind of performer because she's excelled in the same ways. And I think that I think that Shiguma, her master, he sees that. I think that Isho is also I think he also sees it and is in denial of it, but he's going to see it even more.
I don't even think he's in denial. I think he saw it the moment you know the moment when Akane first like meets her competition. And his feedback to her was, you know, you don't belong here, right? And yeah. She's like, I know. Because, like, he's implying she's above this level by a large margin. I think that's when he noticed, like, he instantly saw. It's like, okay.
Yeah. It was like, oh, my, like, I think you're probably right. I think he saw her and was, I don't know. There's a lot that I'm, like, excited to find out. Like, how did he feel when he saw her perform? Was it, like, anger that Shiguma had found someone just like their master and he hadn't, like, because it is very much, I think, presented in these chapters that this guy, this god, I mean, what the fuck was his name? He had the
based on what we know,
Kiroku. Yeah,
I think Isho's feelings at that time were excitement because he was after the interview with Akane, after she won. She just wanted to meet him. That was the reward. She said that she'd show him that her dad's Rakugo is like good enough.
Yeah.
And left. And he's excited about the future of Rakugo because of her. So I think he is a Rakugo above all person, even if it means him eating shit for it or his ego being humbled or whatever, right?
Yeah.
I think as long as Rakugo thrives, he's happy.
Well, and I also think, I think this is, maybe not obvious, but to me it feels pretty obvious that we're kind of being set up to be like, oh, Isho's the conservative, the old guy who doesn't want change. I think what we're being shown in this flashback is that that's not who he is. I think we're being seen that he is actually more just I want to say he's more focused on his own master, on Kiroku, right? This guy. And I think that maybe one of the reasons why he's so like tough and hard and a hard ass on everybody is that we're starting to see here is that his master is going to be betrayed, and that's where we get these kind of split off school thing that's about to happen probably like in the next chapter. And I think that Isho is still mad about that. And I think that he maybe now sees in Akane finally like I can finally show the world a performance like my master had that everyone ignored and said was bad, because I've been looking for literally the chosen one, Akane, like this whole time. Like, so I think that that is what's coming.
Yeah, I, well, okay, hold on. Let's speak on this more after we go through the chapter, because I want to add on to that. That's a good call out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so yeah, so we get this idea that he performs in this very kind of, you know, rooted in the old style, but with his own twist, you know, wove a tapestry of stories. And like, again, this tapestry of stories is what we discovered as Akane's, like, Rakugo superpower, you know, like earlier in the year, where she can, like, weave them together, you know, weave together the different stories that she knows. And yeah, so they said, like, basically, like, hey, he was so thrilling because everything was all classics and he was new and different. And yeah, there was this idea of like maybe he'll be the one to bring change to the world of Rakugo. This is going to be a Darth Vader Luke Skywalker situation where Darth Vader did not bring the change. Luke Skywalker brought the change. His son did. Anyways,
yeah, but I'm curious if this becomes a Darth Vader situation and that this guy does something evil.
But probably not.
Well, no, I mean like because he has a decision to make right at the end of this chapter. But we'll see.
Yeah, yeah. So all this stuff, and then basically the Shigima and Isshō both get told, like, hey, it's been 2 years, like, you're finally getting an appearance. He says, you know, they put me in charge of this daytime slots or whatever for this big performance. You guys are going to be up there, like, blow them away, don't disappoint me, you know, impress my old master, blah, blah, blah. And says, and so then we get the Kiroku meeting Miruko? I don't remember, but he's like, I will give you the name Miruko Kashiwaya. He basically says, hey, I will promote you to be like the master of the master.
In exchange, you have to my job. Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, like, I will give you like my job. You will succeed me and be the master of this whole branch. It's like in exchange, those two ruffians, you got to get rid of them.
Yeah, so now he has the decision, like the big Rakugo decision of obeying your master above all else, or getting rid of the two kids who love and trust you and you fostered, right? And like taught. And I think the answer of, and this is our Darth Vader situation I mentioned, was like, will he expel them and take over, or will he forego the title and lose all of his like accolades and train them regardless, right?
Well, and I think
I think this was already answered in a previous chapter where we saw the Yakuza guy talk about the Rakugo, this guy, right? The Kashiwaya, and in the war he said, you know, once a Rakugoka gives up his humanity, he has nothing left. And I think this is a move in which you would lose your humanity.
Yeah.
By giving up the people who love and trust you and who you nurtured, right?
Yeah.
So I think based on what he said in that flashback, he is going to forego the title in the next chapter.
I think so. And it's also, so I had to Google it real quick, but so the Arakawa school is the school that we primarily deal with in Akane Banashi. Arakawa is not, the name here is Kashiwaya, right? This is the Kashiwaya school. So I most predictably, I think that because they love their master so much, what he probably does is he foregoes the Kashiwaya title. He founds the Arakawa school with these two pupils, and these two guys are the guys who run it, you know, up until Akane's time modern day. That makes the most sense to me, probably. Because the other alternative is that maybe he takes the name, and then because he tries to do, maybe he sort of forgoes his old, his personal, you know, custom new style, and goes back to the old style, and these two peoples are like, nah, we don't like that, you know, you're betraying who you are, you're falling, you know, older, and then these two guys split off and they start the Arakawa school. Could be something like that. I think it's probably the simpler one. But
I think it's a simpler one just because that he was established as a genuinely good dude in every situation we've seen him in. Yeah. Because he only accepts them once they earnestly apologize to that lady taking care of him.
Yep.
And his flashback in the war about humanity and what it means to be a Rakugoka, or Rakugo master. You know, it's like, I think it all points towards him being a genuinely good person, which would just surprise me, I guess, if he
accepted.
Yeah, I think that it would be a much more difficult story to navigate if he chose to take the old title, and then we have to figure out, because I'm pretty sure this story is being told to. I don't remember, was the precedent for the story being told to Akane that they wanted to hear about Isho and Shima's master, or was it that they wanted to know about the founding of the school? I don't know if it was kind of both of those.
I think it's how they met each other, right?
Yeah, maybe that was it.
I was like, how they know each other. Yeah.
So, I don't know. I'm excited for the next chapter. I think the series continues to be exceptionally great. This is a very good flashback. This is, throw this on the pile. So, is are we going to do it? Probably not next week. Although we could do it next week. We could do the manga awards. Either next week or in 2 weeks, I think we'll do manga awards.
You know what, Bruce? Sorry, but I know we talked through this, but I'm almost like 99% sure that he declines this deal.
Yeah, I think so. I think so.
Mainly because Shigema and Isho split as friends. And that probably comes from different definitions of carrying their master's will.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's like narratively, it is such a solid through line for friendships to like break or drift apart in ways that I think that's what will happen. I think we're actually seeing exactly what the two schools of thought are, right?
We're told, the fourth Miku elevated tradition and formality above all else. He could not abide the thought of ruffians who would scrap. It's more about this like formality and stuff. There's something, maybe I didn't get the page of it, but basically there was part of it that was like, hey, these two guys who have not gone to perform, they know 70 stories, and they know they sort of are trained in the old style primarily, and then they bring new stuff in. So I think the split that we're going to see here is basically that Isho looks at his master and sees a guy who was trained so well in the old style that he was able to bring his new feelings towards it. And I think that Isho is going to be like, well, you have to be perfectly trained in the old style in order to bring anything new. And then I think Shigema thinks like, bring in the new shit, like bring it now. And I think that's where their split comes from. I'm going to predict that their split basically comes from Shigema saying, go try new stuff all the time, always be doing new things, be new and different. And I think Isho's going to be like, no, get your basics right. You know, learn the old classics, and once you've perfected the old classics, do the new stuff. Because they already seem more like, right? Like Isho's the more serious, you know, do things this way. Even though they're both kind of quote-unquote ruffians, Isho seems much more serious, and Shima's much more laid back. And I think it might literally just be that personality clash that splits them up.
And yeah, and if you think about it, right, like, it's like this art form in particular, you can get multiple things out of a piece of art. You and I can look at a painting and get two different, completely different meanings out of it. But neither of our meanings are incorrect.
Yeah.
So same with their master's Rakugo performance. They're probably getting two different values, or they're seeing the appeal in two different angles. And I can see that being a narrative through line is what I'm trying to say in how they split up in the first place.
Well, and I also wonder, so this all ties back to sort of the very start of the series where Isho fires essentially a bunch of Rakugoa. Including Akane's dad. And we don't really know the reason for that yet. I think it could be one of two reasons. Either he saw them perform and he basically says, you aren't good enough and you have to be so good at the basics that to bring something new that you'll never be good enough to bring something new, so get out. Or he looks at them and basically says, you are never going to bring anything new. You're just doing what's been done before. Get out. I think that one's more likely. I think the second one, I think it's actually Isho we're going to find is that he is looking for someone like his master who can bring the new stuff and keep, like I think we talked about this before, but both these guys are looking to keep Rakugo alive in the modern age where it's less popular. And part of that has to do with bringing new talent and new angles and new storytelling ideas and stuff into it.
I will say, Isho did give his reasoning for firing Akane's dad, but are you stating that what he said is not the whole truth? It's just part of the truth.
Because I agree. Remind me, what did he say?
He said basically when he went up on stage, he mentioned how he was new at this or nervous or something, and the audience clapped. Mm-hmm. And Isho felt that the audience clapped because they were sympathetic and not because they were enjoying the performance, which is true. But I also feel, I like you, also feel like that wasn't the whole truth as to why he fired Akane's dad.
Yeah. I think both Isho and Shiguma are both essentially looking, I mean, I think one of the reasons why we're seeing this flashback, right, is that clearly Akane is the inheritor of their master's like will, and that story, it's pretty directly stated, like she knows that story, she'll be the one to tell it probably at the climax of the whole story, and that'll be, you know, the thing that blows Isho and everyone away. So it seems to me like both Shiguma and Isho are both looking for a Rakugo like their master. And the people they are training, they think have the potential to do that. And I think basically in the simplest way, that Isho probably looked at those people that he fired and said, you're not it. Like, for whatever reason, either you're not good enough, or you're not classic enough, or you don't have the confidence, or you don't have the ability, or whatever it was. He basically looked at Akane's dad and said, you're not good enough, which I think that the more and more as we learn in the story is that Akane's dad was probably okay at Rakugo. He was probably not actually as good as most of the people we've seen perform here, right?
See, you know, I do believe you're right in that they're both trying to inherit their master's will, but I think what Isho sees is what you mentioned, in that Isho is looking for talent. Isho is looking for people who can elevate Rakugo, like his master.
Yeah.
But Shiguma sees the quality of his master that nurtured his pupils and nurtured happy people who like Rakugo.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
I think that's the fundamental difference, in that Shiguma's not trying to nurture talent, but nurture people. You know?
Yeah, I like that.
Isho is the opposite. Good. Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. The idea that Isho is looking for someone who performs like their master, and Shiguma is looking for someone who is a person like their master.
Shiguma is trying to do what his master did for him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Inspire people the way his master inspired him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I can see that.
At least that's what it seems like based on both of their characters so far.
Yeah. I definitely think we're if we're not on the right track, we're parallel to it. I think we're
I think we're close. I have a feeling we're close.
It's definitely because this story has been extremely good at setting up character motivations and all this stuff. So this makes me even more excited to get back to Isho and Akane, because I think after this flashback, it's going to be a lot of like, oh shit, she reminds me of Master over and over again, and he's gonna be enthralled by that. So I think I'm ready for that. Or he's gonna be mad that she's like his master, and it pisses him off because he reminds him of losing, you know, his master, losing a better time. So
I'm curious. Akane is so damn good, man. So
he's so good. Yeah. Anything else about this chapter here, Dalton?
No, I think we covered it.
Cool. Let's get into Drunk Bullet. This is Drunk Bullet Chapter 20 by Yanagi Takakuchi. We haven't talked about this since... Have we talked about this since Chapter 1? Maybe one time?
Maybe like the Al Capone chapter?
Yeah, I think we brought this one other time.
You want to just... I'll do like a quick kind of synopsis on where we're at. It's not going to take long.
Yeah.
Basically, because I don't think anyone reads Drunk Bullet, and they should.
They should. It's good.
Basically, Drunk Bullet is about this ex-soldier who fought in the war named Gary. This is during the Prohibition era of where basically alcohol was banned in America, and the sale of alcohol was banned in America. And Gary was so looking forward to a drink. And basically, him and his group of misfits are traveling around America just looking for new drinks to try. Their goals are very small, but the stakes are very high, because they always get into trouble.
They basically keep running into very well-named mobsters from the late 1910s and early 1920s. Like you said, like Al Capone shows up. The guy who's in this arc, I can't remember his name.
Torrio.
Yeah, I looked him up and it was like, oh yeah, he was the guy who trained Al Capone and was like considered one of the smartest mob bosses of all time. It's like, oh, cool.
And I love how he was portrayed this arc. Yeah. I think we can talk about that a little bit before we get into it, because he is portrayed as like borderline sociopathic, right?
Mm.
In that he is charming and reasonable and is just friendly at all times. And then as like, soon as he smiles, he'll also slit your throat.
Yeah, I was going to say, literally, like, he'll snap his fingers and he'll slit your throat. Or, like, he'll call you to a meeting and blow up your car, which is what he did in this one. So, yeah, he's super cool and interesting. The takes of all these characters, like, this is... Like, these are some of the best, like, new characters, like, as a... Like, there's not been a bad character introduced in this series. Like, they're all the bad guys are good. All the side characters are great. I really like the five rats?
Five
rats, I think, are great. I really liked the soldier and his twin, I think, in this whole arc, I think, were great.
That was great. I very much also liked, I'm forgetting his name. What's the blonde-haired kid's name? The boy?
Yeah, I did. Paul?
Paul. Yes. I like Paul. He's like a... I thought he would be like this boring voice of reason character, but he is like a incredibly earnest guy.
Yeah.
And he's like charming in his own way.
Well, and I really like the girl whose name I've also forgotten. I think she's hilarious. She's
Mona.
Like,
Mona.
Yeah, she's like my favorite part. She's like, if something happens, it's like, whoops, you drunk too much.
She's like Goblin. I appreciate the chaos she brings.
Yeah, and I like the reporter girl who shows up and is just like, I'm here, right? Tabloid shit. Give me dead people and drunk stuff.
Doesn't the reporter feel like a persona character that you'd like meet? It's like helps you like
now that you say that, yes, it reminds me of a combo of the reporter girl in P5 and the teacher, like a little bit of the teacher and the doctor, like all three of those put together.
Yeah, like the doctor a little bit. Yeah, I agree.
Also, Gary is also just the best because anytime he's like, "Sorry, I don't know how to make a Sazerac," he's like, "Oh my god, I'm gonna die. I would like to die now."
So this arc, they basically Toriel hired them for a job to take out the five rats who have been destroying his businesses.
Mm.
They accept because Toriel promises them a case of beer, and Gary's all about that.
Like, we're gonna do it. And he's like, "I will give you 24 Budweiser," and he's like, "Absolutely, yes, sir. Shake my hand."
And note that alcohol is worth its weight in gold during Prohibitionary America.
And to Gary, it's worth triple that. So
yeah. And for some scene setting, he learns he worked with this other guy in the war, this dude's brother. I think his name is Charles. And Charles died in the war, but he met his twin brother, who's one of the five rats that he was meant to take out. They had a conversation. He found out that Gary was in the war with his brother, and they instantly liked him. And Gary's put in a predicament where he doesn't want to kill the five rats. But he essentially brings the twin brother over to Toriel so they can all talk it out.
Mm-hmm.
Toriel's like, "I know I burned down your town, but you know, like, you didn't give up the land to me like I asked, and we offered you a bunch of money and you didn't." And essentially he's trying to strong arm this dude, and negotiations broke down. He blew up, like, the last meaningful thing to the twin brother, a car left by his deceased brother. Yeah,
they go into, like, a whole big flashback where they were like, it was the only, we saved up for years, it was our thing, we were going to give it to our, you know, we were going to give it to the brother when he got back. It shows them, like they have some good visual storytelling, I guess maybe two chapters ago, where they, like, drive to the boat that's supposed to drop their brother, his brother off to get, when he gets back from the war, and they, it shows them, like, driving to a... dressed up and driving to a cemetery because he is like because he died and they told him that when they got off the boat. So
yeah. So the car is like the most, since Charles is dead, to Ralph the twin, the car is the most important thing in the world to him. That's his life. And Toriel blowing it up took away everything. With this, Gary like pulls out his gun and him and Ralph like shoot their way out of the situation. And he tells Toriel, Toriel's like, "Why are you doing this? It's like, you won't get your Budweiser this way."
Yeah.
And Gary's like, "I don't like you, and you're the kind of guy who takes away everything from people."
Mm-hmm.
That car meant everything to him, and you robbed him of that. And I think that's an important line because it comes back around at the end in a cool way. End of this chapter in a cool way. But essentially, here we are in the chapter. They all got away. They didn't kill Toriel, but they got out with their lives. And Ralph learned something from it.
It is very strange that conveniently
really nobody really dies in this one. It's kind of funny how there's like massive shootouts and like a dude gets like stabbed, like shot twice in the legs and then thrown off like a 50-foot bridge into water, and like he's fine. He makes it out.
Yeah, I think it's not that kind of story.
Yeah, it's right. It's more about the there's fighting and gunfights and people get shot and nobody dies and you just have to accept it. So.
Yeah, you just accept that it's like, and plus Gary's whole thing is that he doesn't
want to kill like people.
Yeah, he'd rather not. He's already been in the
he's
war.
Very good at it, but he's not allowed to. Yeah. He reminds me, honestly, like, do you know who he reminds me of the most? He reminds me of Vash from Trigun.
Yeah!
Like that's exactly the kind of character he is. He's very much like Vash.
Yeah, he's a Vash that is... I don't know, a little less traumatized, I suppose.
Yeah, a little less traumatized guard, a little less goofy, but still the kind of like, I am hyper-competent gunman,
yeah.
But I don't want to fight people. But yeah, I just thought of that. Like, he reminds me of Vash a little bit.
I appreciate Gary as a character a lot, too, because so many people want to, like, partner up with him, you know? Everyone's like, I like the cut of your jib, Gary, let's partner up. And he's like, you're not my type of person. I don't really like you that much. You're a coward. So yeah.
Yeah.
Like he just like rejected Alcaphone. I thought that was very cool.
Yeah.
How many people he despite liking him, he doesn't like them, and he just moves on with it.
Yeah. But basically, it's fun because we're getting a pattern emerging where like an arc finishes and then you get like a drink or a type of alcohol made and then it like gives you the history of it, which I think is really cool. So in this chapter, the drink is I think it's called a Sazerac. Sazerac, which I've heard of, but I've never had. But apparently it's this kind of like sweet whiskey drink thing. And they sort of talk about it and they're like, oh yeah, you know, my brother used to have a sweet tooth, and they're like, oh yeah, I bet he... I bet your brother like hid that from us so he could be the strong guy in the unit. And we get like a little history of like, okay, Sazerac used to come from like grape distilled cognac and blah, blah, blah. And like some really cool like art here at the bottom. Like this is just a great framed like panel here. Like I just really like this.
Yeah, the whole family in the glass, right? It represented in the glass. That's an incredible panel. You're right.
Yeah. So that's really great. And then...
I also think it's very sweet how there's only four of them, but they're called the Five Rats in honor of the brother.
I didn't even occur to me until you said that, but I was like, there's not five of them. I feel like I was always just like, oh, they just aren't showing all five of them at the same time. But yeah, no, you're right, it's the brother. He's the fifth, so yeah.
Yeah.
And end of the chapter here, we get this guy all panicked, like, what room is he in? Like, you're going to visit, like, goodness, with that thug, you've been getting all types of thugs in here. We get the kind of the fat assassin guy who is second to Toyo. He's like, I figured you'd be lonely, so I sent someone to keep you company. And it's Al Capone, the goofball, who is great in this series.
He's great. I like how they humanize the bad guys.
It's weird because this is not really Al Capone. It's a character who has the name Al Capone and is in the same location as he was in that year. But really, like surely this is not who the character really is. But
you know, I've seen The Sopranos. They all love their meat pies and their moms all bake cookies, you know?
And the gabagool, yeah.
And the gabagool, yeah.
we get kind of a good send-off here of, like, of Brad, like, yeah, so here's Mona being, which is like, she does this every time. She's like,
she smashes the glass. So there's one page we skipped here that I wanted to point out in reference to Toryo as a character. At the end of this phone call, if you go back one page, this phone call with the chubby guy, says to him, well, boss, I think I get those guys now. They love their car. They can't live without it. Just like I can't live without cake. And Toryo's face goes from smiling to just like baffled. And then he's frustrated, throws the newspaper he's reading in the trash, and says, "Everyone in the city's nothing but lost causes everywhere." This is because he mentions earlier that alcohol. Chasing alcohol is not a goal, like he says to Gary and crew when he's hiring them. Chasing, like, alcohol is an accessory to your life. And he doesn't drink, but
He says alcohol is an accessory to your life. You have to chase goals. You have to set a goal and pursue it. That's what living life is about. And he sees that's logic. That's a logical state of mind and pursuit. But he can't empathize with things that have meaning to people. He can't empathize with the emotions others feel. Sees them as lost causes. Just like the car, and just like how this guy mentioned the cake, how he gets it, because he's like, I can't live without cake. He's like, he sees him as a lost cause now, too, because he's being sentimental. He doesn't understand
sentimental. Yeah, well, I think with the cake thing and the car thing, it's like, oh, these people have other things they care about other than their goals. And I think that's why he's like, oh, he's a lost cause. Because like, he's got something else he cares about. If you aren't solely focused on the goal, which to him, obviously, is be the best mobster, make money, or something, I guess, but something like that.
But this is also, I think, a reflection of how other characters, and maybe some people in the audience might perceive the character's goals of just, like, trying one drink in every new place and putting your life on the line for it as, like, a meaningless endeavor. It's like, that's not what it's about. That it's not about, like, being immensely productive or getting the bag or pursuit of, like, a lofty goal. Yeah. It's appreciating the small pleasures in life to their fullest. And that is completely unrelatable to a person like Torrio, to the point where he thinks it's just stupid. But it makes perfect sense to someone like Gary and Ralph, you know, who are in the moment experiencing each other's company and having a good time. Right?
Yeah, it's not the journey, it's the destination type thing. Where it's like, it's not about the Torrio is a destination guy. He's a goal, I'm getting somewhere. And everybody else, or most everybody else, is more of an enjoy the journey. That's the point type thing.
So, I think it's reflective on how he doesn't tell his wife anything. He's just frustrated alone in his house. And Gary is surrounded by friends having a good time.
Exactly. You can tell who the true winner is. One guy leaves frustrated and throws stuff away. And they're like, you're right. Literally everybody else is happier. So, yeah, I wonder if Torrio is going to end up being kind of like the big bad. Because apparently he was literally like, he was the mobster before Al Capone was like the mobster.
I don't know. How do you do this without altering history? Right.
Well, I mean, it's as historically accurate as the series is, and it really is quite accurate. Oftentimes, the events and the characters all clearly pretty different. So I would not doubt that they could swap that up. Also, I very briefly read Torrio's Wikipedia page. He may have had an arm in St. Louis, but I don't think he was ever really a mobster in St. Louis. So that isn't really true, but. There was something, I think two or three chapters ago. There was something that I wanted to bring up about the brother, Charles. What was your take on how he died? Because it wasn't made super clear to me in the chapter, and I'm wondering what you think happened.
I think he got captured and executed.
Okay, I wasn't sure if it was captured and executed, or if he was dishonorable and got executed by America. It looks like he was a foreign force, but I couldn't be sure.
I think it's a foreign force in that he died being captured by the enemy and shot in the head.
Because
I think if it was dishonorable, it would have been.
I think that would have come up. When I first saw it, I was like, Holy shit! Did he kill the wrong people and they executed him? And then it wasn't really clarified.
His fart was so bad that he got.
Cool. Anything else about Drunk Bullet?
No. Again, it's nice to see, I guess, black people in manga. It's just like a rare occasion, right? Like every single time, it's just cool to see representation, and this is kind of the perfect spot for it.
Yeah, considering this is like American.
I mean, we've talked about this in the past, but this is clearly written by someone who is like an America boo.
Like not a weeaboo. Like someone who's clearly into America in the early 20th century. Because, like I mentioned, All of her historical shit is correct. Like, the people were there in that location. This is the way it worked. Everything about the alcohol is right. I really like the series for being kind of thorough in that way.
Me too. And I'm glad they weren't like the bad guys
I caught up on this morning when I was reading, and I was like, when they introduced them, I was like, oh boy, I hope we don't step on this landmine, and then they did. I was pretty sure, I was like, oh, those, you know, these, the five rats are going to be the good guys, and I was like, yeah, okay, they are, so.
It was a very sweet chapter too. I think like just a solid conclusion. I don't know how well the series is doing or how well it will do, but at the very least, it's got a lot of heart, and I like it.
No idea, but this, I mean, yeah, this. I wish this author would never be in Michonne Jump because it's about alcohol, but I want this author to get a chance at the big leagues because I think they're like awesome, like they're a really good writer, they have really cool ideas, they're like, yeah, I don't know, like I said, every character introduced in this is a great character. So
I like that too, but I hope that this keeps going instead.
I hope so, I think if it keeps going and catches on, it could be a big one, I think it's really good.
Me too.
Cool. Let's talk news, because there was a little bit of news here. Speaking of reprints and what is doing well, Shiba Inu Rooms got a reprint, which I'm pretty hyped about. I think that is another really, really good Jump Plus series. I don't know if you're currently reading that one week to week.
I think I'm like three chapters behind, but I've been liking it a lot.
Hina 10 also getting a reprint. I have stopped reading Hina 10. I understand why it is popular because Michonne Jump, it was absolutely time for it to just reprint whatever that series was that I forgot the name of. That is exactly like Nisekoi. It's basically just Nisekoi. Yeah. And you know what? It's been almost 10 years since Nisekoi finished, so it's perfectly in line to reprint something that's exactly like Nisekoi. So I'm not surprised that's successful. It's not bad. It's just, I don't know. I've read Nisekoi, so I know what it is.
Hey, listen, man. It's the same as every other romance series I've read. Show me something with ghosts and bondage, is what I'm saying.
But also, for Hina 10 specifically, there are always new people getting into manga and reading, and the fact that there hasn't been one of these kind of generic multi-harem-esque romance type things in Michonne Jump in a couple years, basically since Nisekoi ended, there might have been one or two that tried, but none of them ever really caught on. So I'm not surprised this is catching on. There's a whole new group of people reading the series, especially here in the West, that have not read something like Totally Fair.
And you know, it's an interesting spot to have criticism on things because it's filtered through our 30-something-year-old vision of having read similar things. So our feedback may be unfair to someone who is just getting into the genre and thinks it's great. Because it probably is, you know? Like, who knows? Our metrics aren't for everyone, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, so those two getting reprints. Let's cover this one last. That's going to be a long one. Akabane, Honeko, Bodyguard, and I think you can catch up with that. It's not very long now. I mean, it's only like about two years that ran.
So I think we podcasted the whole time that ran.
But that was fun.
I should too.
Yeah, I liked it. It turned out to be a lot shorter than I thought. But so be it. Welcome to the Demon School Rumikun Season 4 anime announced.
Can someone in the comments tell me if that anime ever got a budget? Because I remember Season 1 had a shoestring-ass budget. So I don't know. I'm curious if, based on the popularity of Irma, That season two, season three, any of that got an actual shonen budget of some kind.
I wonder, because usually budgets go down after season one, unfortunately.
But yeah, they gave him like 50 bucks for season one, I think. Yeah, I don't know. Gatun left a comment here that says,
Akasen interview, this is how he always wanted Oshinoko to end. Liar. We talked about this last week with our last episode.
So I read a Twitter thing, interview with Akka, who said that this is how he intended Oshinoko to end. I don't believe that for a second. I think that's a fucking lie.
I mean, he did too much work before, in the middle parts of this manga,
for this not to feel like the truth to me.
Yeah, we basically talked about all this in the last episode, so go check out that episode if you're curious. We had a couple of nice, well... A couple of nice comments, it is nice for us to get comments. They were not nice comments toward Oshinoko and Akka, because they were very down on that ending and frustrated. Like, I think everyone was.
I truly don't know a bigger like slap in the face of the audiences like in recent times than Oshinoko's ending.
Yeah, I mean, even like we didn't really like the end of My Hero Academia, but a lot of people did. Like Titan was one of those ones that was kind of divisive. Oshinoko's ending, I don't think is divisive. I think everyone hates it. I don't think there's anyone who's like, what a great ending to a good series. Like, I think everyone dislikes it. So
yeah. Well, I mean, I would say that Oshinoko's ending felt like a betrayal. As dramatic as that is, it was like a betrayal of audience expectations in like a major way. Whereas the other ones could have just been like, at least we saw what they were going for, right?
Yeah. We don't get into too much.
Anyway, it's all on that last episode.
We got a U.N.R. Poll Opposites anime announced, which is good. That is a good series. The studio on that is Studio Lapin Track, which I had not heard of, so I googled. They have not done very much. They have about six anime and a couple of OVAs and one movie. They were in charge of both Maro Pinkindrum movies. I don't know if you're familiar with that series.
They saw the first episode of the show. I don't know anything about
it. Man, you want to get into the comments for this one? I fucking hate that show. That was sold to me probably 10 or 11 years ago now. This is Maro Pinkindrum. I do not like that show at all. It is fake smart. It is not real. It is a dumb person's take on what they think smart. Smart philosophy is. It's not. It is stupid.
Is it a show about philosophy or something?
It tries to be, no, it's not really about penguins at all. I kind of remember what it's about, but it collapses in the back half, in my opinion. The start of it was really interesting. It's a weird kind of sci-fi philosophy show, I guess I would say, but I don't know. Go check it out, make your own decision. I hated it. But the movies were well animated from what I saw. So yeah, I hope this is good.
Yeah.
And then, let's talk about the big news. Lots of bustling in Japan as Sony announces it is interested in buying Kadokawa. So I saw this from the angle of video games, because Sony obviously owns PlayStation. Kadokawa owns a lot of things you might be familiar with in the manga space, right? Kadokawa owns Book Walker, which also technically is a subsidiary of Geeks Plus. So if you watch Trash Taste or listen to Trash Taste, or a fan of Garnt, Sea Dog, and the anime man, who's Joey, and Garnt. It's potential that those guys would be employed by Sony, which would be interesting. They also own, let me find, what is publication? Kadokawa, they own a lot, they are an extremely large thing. Kadokawa also owns From Software, if you're into video games, which is one that video game people are all kind of interested in. Kadokawa is a very similar kind of company to Sony. They don't do the hardware side as much as Sony does, as I understand, but they are a media conglomerate, right? They own gaming, they own publication, they own group media, they have overseas stuff. I'm just kind of scrolling through everything they've got here. Films, right, they own Dogo Kobo, who animated Oshinoko, coincidentally enough. They have NG Studio, 53% ownership of NG Studio. NG did. They're doing upcoming Middle List. Let's see if they do anything else. They did Uzaki-chan. Yeah. So... Kadokawa anime. Yeah, I mean, they just own media things. So this would be a conglomeration. Sony would become a bigger conglomerate. We don't know what's going to happen. A lot of people are talking about how it might be part of, part of this might be that I think there was a Korean company trying to buy Kadokawa, and so... Sony basically was like, no, stay in Japan, we don't want you owned by a foreign company. Could be stuff like that. But yeah, for the manga kind of angle of this, part of this, so... Part of this is the angle of... Let me pull it up here. Yeah, it's interesting. How this would affect manga, I don't know. In general, Sony is a much better global company in servicing people who are not in Japan. They are good at that. So that potentially might make things look like Bookwalker, better service to use over here. Leverage things like that. But yeah, this is potentially big news if it goes through. I don't even know if it will, but yeah.
I don't know how I feel. Mainly because I don't want FromSoft games to be PlayStation exclusive.
And they haven't released a 60 FPS Bloodborne.
Those scumbag fuckers haven't put that out yet. So I don't know. Like, will we get Simon Club PC releases for FromSoft games? If this acquisition goes through. That's my biggest worry. In regards to manga, I have no idea if there will be any impact. Like what changes?
Well, Sony has their own manga thing, but I don't remember what it is. Do they not? No, it's just as much news about Sonic Mankind. I don't know.
Yeah, the gaming side. I mean, in general, I think Sony and Microsoft have both figured out,
like, hey, console exclusives make less money. Let's try to be on everything. So I think Sony took a little bit longer to learn that. But yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting to keep track of. That would be a big Japanese acquisition if it happened. I mean, it's potential for stuff like that, that Sony might be like, hey, let's, you know, make a new manga publication or, you know, increase the Bookwalker stuff. Who knows? So it will be interesting to hear. And I will be keeping track of it. I have not heard anything from the Trash Taste guys. I wonder what they're thinking. Because we've both been a part of a company that got acquired at some point by another buyer. And it generally does shake things up, at least at the companies that we worked at our size. So it does, in mostly shitty ways, to be honest.
Because the people at the bottom of the totem pole don't see a dollar out of it. They just have to change everything, the way they do everything.
And generally, you're being bought because you are successful in the way you're doing things. And then if anything changes, you are less successful. So, scary. Okay, cool. I think that's it for the news, unless there's anything else that comes up. Let's talk. I only have one picture because we're kind of talking about the same thing. Gautam, you're playing the new TF2 set, which is based on my one more thing, which is Arcane Season 2, which has ended. So why don't you go first, and then...
Honestly, let's just combine ours, because this is going to end up being kind of a hybrid TF2 Arcane talk anyway.
Yeah, as per the usual quarterly addictions, I'm addicted to TF2 again.
At least for this week. And there's a lot of Arcane characters. I haven't seen Arcane. It seems good. In the game, there are Arcane original characters that their models are pretty good. But the art and the models are lower quality than...
Oh, really? A little bit lower quality than the official Riot models.
Gotcha. And you can tell which one, like Smeech. Smeech is clearly such a show original character, so is Xander, so is that one lady with the sniper rifle, the one on the bottom left of this picture.
Oh, yeah, Maddie?
Maddie, yeah. All of their models and art are slightly lower quality, so you can tell. But it's a very good set so far. I'm enjoying it. Arcane seems cool.
It's good. I finished the series, so the last three episodes of season two, which is the end of Arcane, the series, came out on, I guess, Friday, late Friday, like stayed up late and watched them. It's good. The end is a little rushed, would be my one complaint. The end really needed a little bit more room to breathe, which is not an uncommon thing to be saying about endings nowadays. It really felt like they wrote 100 pages and the guys got back to them and said, this season needs to be 70. And they were like, okay, I guess we have to shrink it down. But that's just from a storytelling angle. From a, like, visual perspective, This is maybe the greatest animated thing of all time. Like, it's so fucking good.
I saw the budget, and I'm like, okay, does this make sense? After I legit only saw the clips that played in the League of Legends client. And I'm like, holy fuck.
That looks so good.
Yeah, that's insane.
And the budget's not even that big. Like, they spent $250 million to make two seasons of this show. Like, for comparison, I think the second, what was it called? Into the Spider-Verse cost? Like, I think Into the Spider-Verse cost, like around $100 million. So it's like they basically got two, like, so they $100 million for like a 2-hour movie, and they produced probably around eight, maybe nine hours of content. Over probably 8 hours of content for $250 million, which is like, realistically, they basically made 6 movies, right? Like every 3 thing arc is about the length of a movie. They made 6 movies for $250 million, or the 2 Spider-Verse movies probably cost $200 million. So I think they're getting a pretty good return on their money. I think it is amazing. I think everyone deserves to watch it. I have some very minor complaints about some stuff that other people like that I just don't like. Like, especially in season 2, they like to do these like storytelling vignettes with pop music of some kind behind them, and I got real fucking tired of those pretty quick. They look great. I'm just so tired of like, oh, instead of just sort of like showing you what's happening and doing visual storytelling, they're like, let's do a pop music weird art thing and just do these weird styles, which I appreciate them for their artistic value, and I do not, they felt like they interrupted the flow of the story and stuff for me, so I don't know.
Are you not a vignette music person, or is this the type of music?
Well, I am when they are used sparingly. In the first 5 episodes of season 2, there's like a 9 of them. There's like nine or ten of these music vignette storytelling things, and it's like, and some of them are really good, and others are just kind of like, okay, why are we doing this again? I don't understand.
That's a lot.
There's also a complaint that I've had about modern media for the past, I don't know, 5 or 6 years, where visual media refuses to let you feel a moment without putting fucking music under it, and I just want more silence in my TV media, especially. Like, shut up. Like, sometimes the music needs to shut the fuck up and let me feel what I'm feeling instead of having like some guy in the background singing about like, I'm sad and when I'm sad it rains. It's like, man, come on, like, just stop putting music under every single scene that tells me how to feel. Let me feel the way I'm feeling anyways. And this is a very minor complaint, but I thought they do that a little too much, but I get it.
I get where you're coming from. I think it's inevitable. I think music inevitably brainwashes us, even those who are cognizant and aware that the music is used to manipulate a certain emotion.
Yeah.
It still manipulates the emotion anyway, like magic. Anytime Trisha's Lullaby plays, I legitimately feel a spark of emotion in my heart. Trisha's Lullaby from Full Metal Alchemist.
Yeah.
I feel like a twinge of sadness in my heart, and I'm like, even outside of the context of the show, she's like, music is just that effective.
It really is, yeah.
Telling, I don't know, inspiring emotion that, even though I agree with you, a scripture should stand on its own, it's like the salt in a dish.
There's so many moments where, you know, there's like some big, like someone is like, confesses like, I love you, and you're like, oh, shock, surprise, and you're like, oh my gosh, what does this mean? And then immediately they play the sad music, and you're like, oh, this means I'm supposed to be sad. You just told me immediately how to feel, instead of letting me figure it out as the scene goes on. You're just like, they play the sad music, I'm supposed to feel sad. Like, that is what drives me crazy, is that instead of just like letting you feel what's happening and like playing it along with the people in the scene discovering it, they're like, you're like, oh, what's happening? And then they play the sad music or they play the scary music, and you know exactly what's happening. Like, horror movies are, I don't watch a whole lot of horror movies, but they are gotten better at this, but there were a couple of years there where it was like, oh, they're playing the scary violin sound. I know that it's about to be a scary thing. And I think they got a little better about it, but yeah, I just shut up. Shut up and let me feel things. Don't play music at every moment all the time.
And sometimes, to your point, musical cues ruin an element of a surprise, in that you can tell a character's giving another one good news and they're both happy, but the music is a little bit eerie, and you're like, okay, this is going to go wrong.
Yeah, exactly. In a way, it's foreshadowing, and in another way, it's
bad. It does not letting you explore and feel the scene. But anyways, yeah. Arcane season 2 is still great. I know that Fortiche at the studio who animated it is going to release a movie that they have been working on, I think pretty soon, maybe in December even. I have to look up when that is. I hope that Fortiche comes back to do more League stuff, because their style rocks. So,
are they making an original movie, or is it like...
They are making an original movie, yeah. It's based on a French, let me see, Fortiche. Studio? Are they not? Yeah, so they are going to release Penelope of Sparta, which is in production. I thought that this doesn't even have a Wikipedia thing, so maybe it's not close. But yeah, they're big names. Like, people are going to see the things that they do now, no matter what. I think Arcane is that big. I think the studio is that quality. I mean, this is, like I said, this is on the level of Into the Spider-Verse, like those movies, which are made by Sony, coincidentally enough.
Yeah.
An enormous billion-dollar company was made by... this was basically animated by a single studio in France that is killing it. So I really, really hope that they come back and do more League of Legends stories, although it did take them 4 years to make season 2, and I think 3 or 4 to make the first season, so I don't know if they can increase that production pipeline or not, but...
I guess it depends on their size and their workload, but I'd be curious.
Rai is also, I know, talking about doing more shows, more media crossover type stuff, so I kind of wonder what the next thing will be. I don't know if they'll just wait another 4 years to do another season of something, but there's lots of cool stories in League of Legends, so...
Just one final thought on this, by the way. So in League of Legends, you know how you can get, like, different champions? TFT, you can get, like, different little legends or whatever to run around the board. There's a Jinx from Arcane 1. The art style stands out from the rest of them.
Because it's like adult detailed. Yeah, everything in Arcane, like, most of the TFT things look like fucking Pengu, who is, like, this goofy little penguin guy. And they introduced a Jinx one that literally just looks like Jinx. Like, it's just...
Her finisher is like when you eliminate a player, some characters have finishing animations. And her finisher is like sad music playing while she fires a rocket at this building. Presumably the end. Inside the building, it's just this goofy little sprite.
gets
like hit with the rocket, and then the music cuts, and then the animation's over.
That's so funny. I will not spoil it because you need to watch the season, but it is so funny that they chose that to be her finisher.
Yeah. It's like, why did that poor little penguin deserve that?
Yeah. You really do need to watch it. Like, watch it 3 episodes at a time. It's really... The season 1 especially, I think, is really fantastic. Like, season 1, I had maybe only like one little issue with, and season 2, I had a couple more, but I still think it's just fantastic, like, through and through. So,
got it. Yeah, it's definitely something to watch for sure.
Cool. Anything else? Are we good to get out of here?
Yeah, let's leave.
Let's get out of here. Hey, thanks again, everybody, for listening or watching. Don't forget to leave us feedback, comments, upvote, like, subscribe, thumbs up, all that jazz. I said thumbs up twice, I think. Check out Twitter and Patreon, which are linked in the description. And thank you for being with us yet again this week.
See you later.
And don't forget to read more manga.